Hi everyone, and welcome back to the Culture Drop Podcast. I'm your host, Jed, joined once again by author and cultural critic, William Devitt. Today will be the first part of a multi-part podcast about the musician Lou Reed of the Velvet Underground and many successful, artistically at least, solo albums. Today we're going to cover the first part of his solo career, 1972 to 1975. So that includes the first album entitled Lou Reed in 1972, the album he did with David Bowie and Mick Ronson, which sounds fantastic, the Transformer album, which has Walk on the Wild Side and Perfect Day on it, his two live albums, Rock and Roll Animal and Lou Reed Live, which are both recorded at the same gig but released on two different albums, one in 1974 and 1975. Backing up the Berlin album, 1973, and concluding our discussion today with Sally Can't Dance.
Hey, let's start at the beginning. Let's go through the months. I'm looking at the months and the year. Okay, Lou Reed, we get two albums in 1972, May 1972, and then Transformer, November 1972.
Yeah.
Then we get Berlin, October 1973. That was quite a long wait in Lou world. But then wait for it. 5 months later, you're enjoying Rock and Roll Animal. And then about 7 months after that, you're enjoying Sally Can't Dance, September 1974. And then, oh, hold on, 6 months later, we'll hit you with Lou Reed Live, March 1975. Metal Machine Music, 4 months later, July 1975. Oh, Coney Island Baby, 5 months later, December 1975. Just goes to show you how prolific he was in those first few years.
Yeah, I don't know. Prolific is the word. I mean, concerning, you know, how much he relied on Old Velvet's outtakes and
Bob Ezrin to do everything for him.
Yeah, he didn't really, he wasn't, he was just pretty much supplied vocals. I mean, after Transformer, for, well, Berlin and Sally Can't Dance, but those tours, and the Rock and Roll Animal tour, and the Blonde, Bleach Blonde tour for Sally Can't Dance. Yeah, he didn't do anything, and he paid the price for you know, playing that character of Lou Reed. He's paying the price, you know, on a personal level, and you know, Sally Can't Dance, I think, is the only album that ever went top 10. You know,
it is or it isn't.
It is.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's trash. It's a trashy album. I like it for what it is. It's, you know, sleazy R&B with session players and Lou, you know, as disinterested as a person can possibly be, you know, in songs they've written and are being recorded, you know, just sort of, you know, mumbling and, you know, doing his Lou vocal shtick. And same for Berlin. Now it's considered this great masterpiece and all that. Lou's barely on it. I mean, he wrote the songs, but they don't sound like. And then, yeah, you know, the live Academy of Music show that produced Rock and Roll Animal and then Lou Reed Live later, you know, it's really nothing to do with Lou or his music or, you know, his ideas. It's product.
Yeah. How do you want to go through this? Do you want to go through chronologically?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, just start at the beginning.
Okay, so Lou Reed was born a baby in Long Island.
Brooklyn, actually.
Born in Brooklyn, grew up in Long Island, right?
Yeah. Lou wouldn't have it any other way. the first album, self-titled first album,
Okay, do you want to say anything about, like, the Velvets or anything before we get into that, or just jump into the first album?
No, really. He'd been out of the Velvets for, the Velvets had, you know, he left the Velvets in, after a series of shows at Max's Kansas City in 1970.
Right.
Which produced the famous, you know, Velvets Live at Max's album, which is, you know, recorded at a table with Bridget Polk and Jim Carroll. And you actually hear Jim talking to one of the waitresses during the course of the show.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah,
pretty bad sounding record.
Yeah.
Great, great performances, though.
Mm-hmm.
Even though Doug Ewell's little brother, Billy Ewell's on drums, and he's playing for all the world just like a white rock and roll drummer would be playing in 1970.
What happened to Mo Tucker?
She was on leave for pregnancy. She
Her
first baby, so she didn't play any of the Loaded album. So they did this, I don't know how long. It was a month, 2 months? Stand at Max's Kansas City playing two sets a night with Billy Ewell on drums. And while they were recording the Loaded album, final album. And they do that on their days off or in the daytime. And so Louis' voice is actually really gruff on a lot of the songs on Loaded.
Really raw, did you say?
Very gruff.
Very gruff.
Yeah. You sing every night and, you know, recording every day.
Yeah.
And so he quit the band before the album was finished and mixed. You know, Doug Ewell did, you know, several lead vocals on several of the songs. And Lou quit the band, moved home to Long Island, and became a typist for his dad.
Right.
And for a couple of years, and did whatever Lou does, did back then, and came back with the, got signed to RCA Records, and, he put on a little weight, and,
Do we know how he got signed to RCA Records, or how that happened at all?
I can't remember. No, I'm sure I've read about it, but it doesn't stick in my memory.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like some, great story or legend. But somehow ended up, we'll do it in London. And so went to London, and they had a... part of the contract, they had to use union musicians from the British Musicians Union. And that's how they ended up getting Steve Howe on guitar, Rick Wakeman on keyboards from Yes, who I don't think had formed yet at that point. If they were just session players. And
I have to say, I love this record. I didn't really know it until I was listening to it to kind of prepare for this podcast. And I know you said, like, vocally it's a little bit weak and he's a little bit low in the mix, which I can hear, but songs like Walk It and Talk It and Lisa Says, I Can't Stand It, they're just all such great songs.
I think it's uniformly great.
Yeah.
As far as the material, of course.
Yeah.
9 out of the 10 songs are late era Velvets outtakes,
right,
which later showed up on compilations and a VU and another VU,
right,
and the Fully Loaded edition of Loaded album.
I did a double take when I heard Ride Into the Sun. I'm like, wait a minute.
I think it's from the Loaded sessions, probably on the Fully Loaded edition.
But like Lisa, I'm just looking at the tracks listing. Lisa Says is on there.
It's one of my personal favorite Lou Reed songs.
Me too.
Yeah. And it's various iterations. The version that showed up on the VU album, the Velvets, and the lyrics are somewhat different, as they often are, and Lou's reinterpretations of old Velvets outtakes is just gorgeous. It's just gorgeous. I mean, it's, you know,
not the original lineup, but Mo Tucker, Doug Yule on bass. That's from 68 to 69. That original version of Lisa Says. I Can't Stand It, the version of that, that's the leadoff song on the View album, and that Velvet's version just slams. This is a bit quicker, this version, and it's got, the R&B, girl singers and doing background vocals, and it's kind of a, it's obviously, they're trying to go for the Stones, Clem Cantini, the drummer, big session drummer, UK session drummer. He even does, Charlie Watts' drum pattern from Brown Sugar, which had, just been released as a single. And they're obviously going for a heavy Stones feel. And they kind of achieve it, but the band, it's, you're competing with Rolling Stones, forget about it. Do your own thing. And he did not know what his own thing was on this record.
Right.
Going Down is the only new song on the record. That's the second song. Mm-hmm. Walk and Talk It, that's from the Velvets, an outtake from Loaded Sessions. Lisa Says, we just discussed Berlin. The original version, a song. I guess that is... I'll have to amend that. That was a new song. That wasn't...
I did a double take when I heard that. I'm like, really? You did Berlin on your first album, and then you're going to call your second album Berlin and do it again? And I listened to both versions. They're very different.
The third album was Berlin, not second.
The third album.
Why did he do that? I don't know. He had a little story in mind for Berlin, for the album.
Yeah.
Which doesn't really hold up, but we'll get to that in short order. It's a beautiful song. It really is. And just the production on the record, Richard Robinson's production, is one of the big downfalls of the record. It's murky. It's quiet. They realized the master tape, they recorded it. The actual engineers had recorded it in Dolby. This is very muted, sound. The low end is cut off.
That's so funny. That's, I didn't realize they had Dolby in 1972.
Yeah, I think it just come out primarily for film, I think, movies. But it later remastered some better. I haven't heard the post, after Lou died. Apparently the whole catalogs are remastered and I think only released on vinyl.
I'd love to hear this record, right?
$1 million.
Remastered.
The remaster, I think from 2000 or 2001, something like that, is pretty good. It's better than the vinyl, the original vinyl. But how Richard Robinson got the job of production, I have no idea. His wife, Lisa Robinson, she's a big music journalist.
I know Lisa Robinson.
Very well liked with musicians, especially cool musicians. I don't really know much about Richard Robinson.
I don't either.
He did, later in 78, he did Lose, was credited with producing his Street Hassle album. Considered, that was Lou's first attempt at the binaural sound, but we'll get to that later. He also produced David Johansson's debut album, self-titled, which the production actually works on that. It's pretty good, but it's very similar, kind of murky, not a lot of high-end, very live sounding. For Lou's... I Love You was from the Loaded Sessions. I mean, the Loaded Sessions, talk about prolific. He had loads of material.
Yeah, that could have been a double album. I love that album.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's not really a Velvet Underground album. Not even really a Lou Reed solo album, concerning Doug Yule's vocals and heavy influence on instrumentation, playing, you know, bass, guitar, keyboards. Wild Child, actually, that might be a new one. Maybe they're not all Velvet songs.
No, I know 8 new recordings. It says on here 8 new recordings of then unreleased Velvet Underground songs and 2 new songs, Going Down in Berlin.
Yeah, so I guess Wild Child, maybe that's also a loaded outtake. I'm trying to think if that's on the Fully Loaded edition, 2-CD edition. Well, that now that's a very Stonesy number. That kind of shows the great intersection between Jagger and Lou's, vocal delivery, or mid-tempo, kind of funky R&B-ish rock and roll. Love Makes You Feel, I always thought was the weakest song on the album. That's a Velvet's outtake from the Loaded Sessions, Riding to the Sun, also, and Ocean. They've been playing that forever, since 69, anyway. And that was later released on the Velvet Underground Live double album with the woman's butt on the cover.
There's a cross, I didn't notice this earlier. They've got a cross reference for which Velvet Underground album these different songs showed up on.
Mm-hmm.
Ocean, 1969 VU and Loaded, Fully Loaded edition.
Yeah, but it was released first in, I think, I forget when it came out, 76, something like that, Velvet Underground Live. And it was all just a fan recording.
Oh, okay.
From the San Francisco and somewhere in Texas, maybe Dallas. And Robert Quine famously recorded a bunch of shows. And
the Quine tapes, which came out officially, right?
Yeah, and that was about as not as good sounding as the Velvet Underground Live double album, which is still really lo-fi, audience recording. But Ocean, they'd expand that. It would be like, 18 minutes long. Mm-hmm. Doug Yule pretty much playing, organ on most of those versions. And on from the Loaded Sessions, there's 2 different versions, and they're pretty much radically different performances. They're not just different, mixes. And one supposedly had John Cale on the organ, and he's talked about it and said, no, my training, I would never do those certain fills and that due to my background. That's got to be Doug Yule. Doug Yule has said, no, that's in fact John, because he showed up at the studio one night and I wasn't there. And so there's another version of Ocean, which either doesn't have the big organ part or it's subdued and different. But there are 2 versions, studio versions of Ocean from the Loaded Sessions that came out in much later on the Fully Loaded remaster.
I'm just looking at the... we should talk a little bit about the musicians on the first album, because Rick Wakeman and Steve Howe of Yes are on there, but there's actually 10 musicians listed here. There's other people who played on the album as well.
Yeah, most of them, I don't know. I can't remember the bass player who he is. Clem Cantini, I think, the drummer.
Percussion.
Played with, I think, a band called The Pirates. Early British, I think, kind of R&B.
The Tornadoes.
Rockabilly band. Tornadoes? Okay, I thought it was The Pirates. Johnny and the Pirates, or whatever they're called.
Put a footnote there. Johnny Kidd and the Pirates, he played on their hit Shaken All Over, which is a great song.
I like it well enough. I only know the Who's version. I've never heard the original. But Cantini sticks out like a sore thumb. He's just all over the kit. He's, around the kit, Tom Phils.
Yeah.
And his drums are really, really mixed really loud on the album, too.
Uh-huh.
So I just think the band wasn't drilled well enough. It's a bunch of just session players. There's no real musical anchor like there would be on the next album with Bowie and Ronson.
It's I like the album cover. I don't know what it has to do with Lou Reed or his music, but it is an interesting painting.
I like it too. I do too, and I agree with you. I have no idea what it, you know, insinuates or what, you know, comes to mind. An urban area, presumably New York City, with this, you know, wave, you know, tidal wave, water rolling down the middle of the street, a little bird popping out of sort of a Russian Easter egg.
Check this out. He also, in addition to various, you know, art things, he did book covers, and he did several covers for Raymond Chandler.
Who's that? The artist who did the album?
The artist who did the album, his name is Tom Adams. He's a U.S.-born Anglo-Scots illustrator and painter. He is known for his work in book cover art, portrait painting, poster, advertising, album art. He's most widely known for his book cover art for the paperback editions of Agatha Christie.
Yeah, it's an evocative picture. I have no idea what it has to do.
Better, you know, Lou Reed suffered from not great album covers throughout his career, so it's actually one of his more interesting album covers, really.
Well, he's had a few good ones. He's had a few, you know, awful ones. Really great records sometimes, and we'll get to that later. I think Lou, kind of like musically in his solo career, or maybe even in the Velvets, either he was trying, and that, of course, you know, in retrospect, that's what he'd say, and what a lot of people say, he was trying for different things, different flavors, different angles, points of view, musically, lyrically, and otherwise.
And I feel the final point on the album covers, you know, after this album, you know, I think it was largely a marketing exercise where he had to have his face on the cover. I mean, that's basically what a Lou Reed cover is for, you know, a lot of them.
For the next album, Nick Rock's famous photo. I think even stylistically, artistically for his album, artwork, it was not so much schizophrenic, but where's the real Lou Reed? What is it? You know, he never had a logo or, you know, a font or typeset, you know, with his name.
Right. That's a good point.
So he had these very disparate, you know, artistic images on his album artwork.
Yeah.
Which kind of reflects his musical, you know, evolution.
Right.
I don't know. You want to move on?
Let's move on to the next one.
Transformer.
Have you seen? You've probably seen that making of TV biopic thing about this album. Have you seen that?
Yeah, there's a series where people talk about
it. Behind the Music, it might have been. I don't know if that's what it was.
I think after, and certainly a lot better than Behind the Music. That's a real fun one with Lou. Yeah.
It's hard to pin it down because you get different perspectives from different people, but one of my general takeaways is, you know, he was kind of detached and uncommunicative, and a lot of it is thanks to Bowie, the engineer, Ken Scott, and was Ronson involved in this one also?
Ronson's pretty much along with completely equals with Bowie on this album.
I mean, I don't know what would have happened. It's an interesting question. What would have happened to Lou Reed if, you know, they didn't kind of pick him up at this point?
Well, Bowie was a huge fan and got a lot from Lou, and the Spiders have been covering Waiting for My Man and White Light, White Heat for a couple of years. I don't know if it was quite do or die for Lou.
No, he already had, you know, he'd already done the heavy lifting of getting a solo deal, record deal. But what a astronomic jump in like record production. When I hear a song like Satellite of Love or Perfect Day, I'm just like, this is just gorgeous. You know, let alone the arrangement, just the whole thing, the song he wrote, everything.
Yeah, a lot of the arrangement is equally, not 45%, you know, maybe even more than 50%, Ronson to Bowie's ideas.
Yeah, just Ronson, great orchestration, everything.
Ronson plays guitar on it. You know, he's a fearsome and beautiful guitar player. And you know, plays piano as well, and, you know, the recorder on, say, Satellite of Love, and does, you know, cool backing vocals with Bowie on many songs. Say, Satellite of Love is a, you know, big example. Bowie is great backing vocals, along with the Thunder Thighs, you know, the girl soul backing vocals. Yeah, it's got the sound of, say, Hunky Dory and Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust, you know, from the
that's right, it's got that glam rock thing, and it starts off with Vicious, and then Andy's Chest, so you've got two Andy Warhol related songs to start the album, because Andy Warhol said to Lou, right, why don't you write a song called Vicious? And Lou Reed's like, what do you mean? He's like, you know, like, hit me with a flower.
Yeah, that's what Lou says. And Lou's pithy and sometimes not so pithy phraseology. Yeah, it sounds like something, you know, if you know anything about Warhol, it sounds like something Andy would say. Well, what kind of Vicious are you talking about, man? Well, you know, Vicious, like, well, you know, you hit me with a flower. Yeah. I'm throwing a flower pot at him or something. Who knows? Lou is liable to say anything, especially during those years.
Yeah.
Actually, forever. And it's... Lou's guitar actually shows up very strong, you know, the rhythm guitar on that track. And Ronson's just deadly guitar, you know, fills, you know, those just razor sharp. It's, you know, it's not metal, it's not, you know, it's Ronson kind of single-handedly inventing glam or glitter, you know.
Yeah.
He's a very accomplished, you know, blues and R&B rock and roll guitar player in the tradition. You know, Jeff Beck, I'm sure, was a big influence on Ronson when he was young. And so, yeah, Vicious really showcases. And it's fun because Ronson said in a later interview, right before he died, they were talking about a lot of things in the interview, but they were talking about working on Lou's Transformer album. And he said, yeah, Lou, he just kind of sit there and he's kind of mumbled and it wasn't really, you know, communicative. And Robson said, yeah, well, you know, I told him, yeah, Lou, your guitar's out of tune. And Lou was like, oh, is it? Oh, okay, can you tune it for me? And then, you know, Lou famously said, I think in that making of the mini documentary that he made reference to, that, you know, he could barely understand Mick's, you know, thick Northern English, you know, Hull accent. You know, it's a city he's from, Hull. It's just considered kind of the armpit of the UK by a lot of Brits, which I've always been able to understand Ronson in interviews and whatnot. So, but Lou obviously had great affection for Ronson. You know, Bowie too, but Bowie's probably a bit more complicated of a character. But Ronson's pretty much, you know, just a real kind of, you know, down-to-earth standard, you know, garden variety,
working class, you know, British musician. Speaking of garden variety, he thought he was going to be a gardener, work for the local council in Hull as a gardener.
So he was in the Spiders from Mars just around the time of this album, and then I see Herbie Flowers played bass. He also played with T-Rex, and John Halsey was best known for his appearance in the television film All You Need Is Cash, where he played Barrington Womble of the Ruddles, which was the Monty Python inspired Beatles parody movie. So John Halsey played Ringo in that movie.
Right. I think the drums are actually the weakest link musically on the album. Mm. Herbie Flowers, great bass player, great session player, actually played two basses on Walk on the Wild Side. Electric and the acoustic, and which gives it that, you know, both bass lines are wonderful just in and of themselves, but you get them together, it's one of the great bass songs in popular music. And he did them twice because he was getting paid, you know, through the union, you know, according to, you know, how many tracks he played on, and, you know, whatever the union buy rules are.
He got paid twice for playing bass twice?
Yeah.
Yes. As he should.
Why we want acoustic, an upright bass on this, a double bass is sometimes known.
Yeah, that's what the English call it.
I think he said that he'd never really played it double, you know, stand-up bass very much. But he said, well, yeah, I can do that. You know, just so he can get the extra pay, you know, for playing.
Oh, sure.
Overdubbed, you know, twice on one track. But yeah, a very, very fine bass player. Played on a lot of great records.
And Walk on the Wild Side, I don't think anyone expected it to be a single at the time, right?
I don't think so. Lou was, but he was as surprised as anybody. So that might have been, you know, Main Man was, you know, Bowie's manager, Andy DeFries, I don't know what she was. But I think Lou was briefly under contract, you know, from Tony DeFries with RCA Records, which, you know, Bowie was signed to RCA Records as well. And so I don't know whose decision it was. It did very well. I mean, I think it got in the charts in the UK and the US. And that's where I first discovered Lou as a, you know, a young, what would I be, you know, 8 years old, 9 years old, whatever, through my, you know, older brothers and sisters. And he was played, Walk on the Wild Side was played on the Nascent KQRS. Back then, it was FM radio. It was just starting up.
It was album-oriented radio when it was didn't have playlists and stuff, probably.
Well, it was, they'd play whatever they wanted. They'd play an entire, you know, Herbie Hancock, you know, triple album, you know, all the way through. They'd play whatever they wanted.
Yeah, that's what I mean, yeah. Okay, so now the next one, should we move on to Berlin then?
If you want, I just want to say that as far as Transformer, a lot of it's a very musical album. Unlike the first album debut, it's very musical, and so songs, particularly on side two, Makeup, with this wonderful floating, you know, electric bass from Herbie Flowers, and the horns, which were, you know, arranged by Mick Ronson. It's a wonderfully campy song, and then later New York Telephone Conversation, which is this little piano, almost Bertolt Brecht or Kurt Vile type of thing with Lou and Bowie doing harmony vocals, a great harmony vocal, which is almost as loud and as strong as Lou's lead vocal. And I think that song was actually taken from, or Lou's
perceived idea of Andy Warhol, you know, talking on the phone. It's one. It's hilarious. It's funny. Yeah. It's about a minute and a half long.
Who's singing the harmony with them?
Bowie, David Bowie.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, and that song clocks in at a tidy 1 minute and 31 seconds.
Yeah, yeah, and it's just a joy. And it's got levity, too. I mean, it's got seriousness. It's, you know, Lou isn't all one thing, you know, on any given song or topic or theme.
I think a lot of people forget that in addition to, like, the rhythmic tough guy Lou, there's the Bertolt Brecht Broadway show tune Lou, you know?
Well, Euro, I wouldn't say Broadway. The European, you know, pre-Broadway.
Sure.
Would be yeah, dirt violin.
Yeah.
You know, early 20th century.
But I guess I say Broadway because, you know, he seems like he's very well versed in, like, the New York City, you know, Brill Building, you know, songwriting tradition, which is very much a lot of the great songs written in New York were for Broadway musicals.
Well, not just Broadway musicals, but actual, you know,
and hits on the radio, yeah.
Pop songs, yeah, right. You know, Goffin and King and Lieber and Stoller, you know, all these great teams. But one more I just want to add. The final song on the album is also in the tradition that we've just mentioned, Good Night, Ladies.
Right.
It's a wonderful, it's funny as hell, and it's sad as hell, too. And again, it's got just this New Orleans staggered, you know, very boozy, woozy, well, maybe even opiated feel to it. Herbie Flowers played tuba. That's the instrument I think that he said he hadn't played, not the upright bass.
Yeah, it says here he played tuba on actually three songs, Perfect Day, Good Night Ladies, and Makeup.
Yeah, I doubt Perfect Day, there aren't any horns on Perfect Day, so that's just Wikipedia being wrong. There's strings on it, arranged by Mick Ronson. And that song, you know, Perfect Day, has gained very much in stature through the years, through the decades. And was,
it feels like that has really entered, like, mainstream culture. Like, I swear I've heard that in, like, various commercials.
They may well have used that in a commercial. I had a couple songs used in TV commercials.
U2 has covered a number of songs in their sets, including Satellite of Love and Perfect Day, I believe, also.
Yeah, they certainly recorded Satellite of Love. I just listened to that last night, as a matter of fact, their version.
His wife, I read an interview, I told you last time, I read an interview with his first wife, and I believe he wrote that song about a day they spent in the park.
Yeah, other people say, no, the song's it's about heroin. So, yeah.
Yeah, who knows?
Perfect Day, yes. Beautiful song, beautiful arrangement, but yeah, Herbie Flowers played on Good Night Ladies, Makeup, and tuba, that is.
Yeah.
And again, he was trying to get some extra pay from the union, musicians union. Good Night, Ladies. Just a wonderful, just sad, and it loses delivery. It sounds like, I don't know if he's actually that way or when he was recording it, if he was in like really drunk or really, really stoned or something. But it's almost like he's overly affecting. Oh, I still miss my other half. You have to listen to the song. Just listen to his phrasing.
Yeah.
And it's almost like he's doing a parody of his own lyrics to make it himself sound more woe is me. It's very funny, even though it's actually a very sad lyric. You know?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's what I got to say about that album. I think it's great. And Mick Ronson, his guitar is just it's some of the best recorded ever. Some of his work with the Spiders at that time. Extremely influential. That's a whole other topic. We've already done, you know, guitar players. But Mick Ronson, his arranging abilities, his cool backing vocals with Bowie.
It's one of the great, you know, outside of just Lou Reed, it's like one of the great albums in the rock pantheon, I think we can say.
I would think so, yeah. It's just got, that's when Lou's personality put on or not, that's when it really started. Lou's, at least for the next couple of years. Lou's going to be this, decadent, reprobate, got a sound, got a very distinct sound on that record, and it's mainly up to Bowie and Ronson. And, of course, Bowie and Ronson using, bringing them into Morgan Studios with Ken Scott to produce, co-produce, and engineer.
Yeah, now it's interesting. We were talking about cover art earlier, and Lou Reed actually did have an artistic input into the cover. According to Mick Rock, cover art was from a Mick Rock photograph that inadvertently became overexposed as he was printing it in the darkroom. Rock noticed the flaw, but decided he liked the fortuitous effect enough to submit the image for the album cover, which Lou Reed loved. The first test he made of the image, Lou Reed, it fell out of focus when he was doing the exposure. Lou loved the results. And then the back cover, which has a man and a woman, was shot by this guy, Carl Stoker, who did the first three Roxy Music album covers.
Yeah, I know the back cover. That's, pretty funny. A lot of people thought that the guy in the picture was Lou, actually, and it was just some guy. He hung around at Andy's, the factory or whatever. Stuffed a banana in his jeans and whatever. And some people even dared to think that the woman in the picture was actually Lou or whatever.
Yeah, it says here the woman was 1960s London supermodel Gala Mitchell. I had to look it up. I wasn't familiar with the back cover. I had to Google it, so it was kind of interesting to see that.
It's a fun picture. It's actually two different photos, but it's a fun picture. And gives you an idea of what the music's about. The front cover is kind of funny. It's very iconic and would be, used again. Sylvia, his second wife, who's a graphic designer, would reuse it and change up, the coloring for his 1982 album, Masterpiece, The Blue Mask. But you see outtakes, Mick Rock's outtakes from that gig, which is the cover. And one of them is used on the American Poet Live album, which is recorded, live in 72 in upstate New York. And, he's got the makeup on and everything. But Lou had some extra pounds there, going on those years. He'd been drinking a whole lot or eating a whole lot of ice cream or both or something like that. I've seen a gig from that tour with the Tots, the teenage American band that he used on that tour, and it's kind of weird. He's got the white face makeup on, his hair's kind of long, naturally curly. That picture, you would never guess that it's a guy who's actually been putting on a few pounds has been out of music, and his speed use hasn't caught up with him yet. Mm-hmm. Turn him into a virtual well, if not a skeleton, at least a reprobate in the next, you know, 2-3 years. So yeah, it's kind of a tricky album cover.
Should we move on to the next one?
Sure.
Berlin?
Sure, yeah.
So we were talking earlier about how, you know, a lot of his songwriting style probably was influenced by the Kurt Weill, Bertolt Brecht, Berlin era. And that's kind of how he conceived this, right? Like a story that happened during this time.
Yeah, I think it's sort of like a lot of so-called concept albums. Somebody had an idea and just kind of, you know, there may be a thread of a story through a few songs.
Yeah.
But that doesn't really hold up. And again, that's, you know, a couple songs that are late era Velvet's outtakes. Well, Berlin, which leads off in an abbreviated, truncated version of it. With some extra sound effect backing tapes effects. It was, you know, from his debut album from the previous year. And Caroline Says is, you know, essentially it's a late era Velvet song. He's got two different versions, you know, vastly different lyrics and music. Oh Jim was originally Ogin, G-I-N, like Jenny.
These are all, looking at the track listing, they're all very short. Most of them have very short titles, like one or two words. Berlin, Lady Day, The Kids, The Bed, Sad Song.
Yeah, Sad Song was also late era Velvets from the Loaded Sessions. Very much to do with very different lyrics. The brevity of the titles that never occurred to me.
Steve Winwood played on this album. Jack Bruce played on it.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Bass guitar, except Lady Day and the Kids.
Yeah, fine players on it. And it's great for what it is. As somebody decided to try and go for this, you know, hyper stylized theatrical sound on a lot of tracks. And that was actually a good idea. Otherwise, you're left with, I forget, either Hunter or Wagner. One of them plays guitar, you know, from the Rock and Roll Animal Band, which would be formed very briefly to tour behind the album. It's, I don't know, got Bob Ezrin involved, you know, what contacts Lou had, or Lou's management. I think everything is up to his manager, Steve Katz, at this point. And Lou would, I think, later sue him and write nasty songs about him and say horrible things about him.
It says here that Reed and Ezrin planned a stage adaptation of the album upon its initial release, but shelved the plans due to mixed reviews and poor sales. But then there was that Julian Schnabel film concert released in 2008, which I kind of enjoyed, which was released to strong reviews.
I kind of enjoyed it too, kind of being the operative word. And Lou's vocals by that time were, I think, not suitable for the material, no matter what Lou would think. My word, man, sing how I want. Okay, Lou.
Yeah, he probably didn't sing it like he did on the album, right?
Well, on the album, it's pretty much he just mumbles and drones, which is great. And working against this very theatrical, for the time, high-tech music with all these, you know, heavy, you know, studio musicians, Steve Winwood, Jack Bruce, Emsley Dunbar on drums, you know, Hunter and Wagner, one or the other on guitar. It's a strange dichotomy.
Yeah.
And then Lou's voice kind of droning on. That's the common thread. Musically, again, it's very little to do with Lou, with the exception of some of Bob Ezrin's over-the-top ideas with strings, masked string sections, and horns. On, say, Sad Song, How Do You Think It Feels, Oh Jim, a lot of them. And it actually works in its favor to give it this grandiosity, which is in stark contrast to this just, you know, miserable, miserable subject matter and just the minimalist, lyrical reportage. The music actually works against the themes, and, you know, the basic songs are, you know, very well composed. They're probably composed by Lou on guitar or piano, and he's a very simplistic songwriter, to his credit. So it's a strange album. It's a very strange, considered, you know, classic, and it is. But again, it's sort of not really musically about Lou Reed.
Yeah, I think it tends to get overlooked, including by me. And like I mentioned to you earlier, you know, when I went back and re-listened to it for this discussion, I was kind of pleasantly surprised by how interesting the arrangements are, and there's a lot of really interesting musicality on it.
Yeah, I think a lot of it's over the top, and there was no big, not even like, you know, a war horse, you know, standout song that Lou played all.
Yeah, no attempt to like have a single, really.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a couple of them probably maybe could have been. You know, there's no cuss words in, say, How Do You Think It Feels?
Yeah.
Just a downer of a song, even with its sprightly, you know, funky rhythm pattern, or Old Jim as well. And plus they were long, but, you know, they could have done radio edits, but it's a downer. It's a complete downer emotionally and psychologically of an album. And the music just is schizophrenic, you know, offering this bombast, this, you know, and this, you know, wailing lead guitar on a few songs, and the horns and the strings, you know, the orchestral effects. It's just weirdness, you know. Lester Bangs, in one of his famous, you know, maybe his most famous interview with Lou, from 1974, after Sally Can't Dance came out, and right before Metal Machine, he said, it's a hilarious interview, and they're both just vicious to each other, and it's utterly hateful on both of the Lou and Lester's parts, and screamingly funny. But Lou, or Lester, says, well, when he first got Berlin, he brought it to a party, and they played it over and over again. It's a room full of people, and they, you know, played it, you know, 10 times or whatever. And he said, by the end of the night, complete strangers were, you know, lobbing these extremely vicious personal ad hominem attacks at each other.
Yeah, talk about a party killer.
right.
Especially when you, like, you want to dance to Motown and you're listening to the Kids.
It's not, I like the song. I like the song, but, you know, when the Kids samples, and that was, apparently it was Bob Ezrin's Kids.
Oh, really?
That they recorded, and whoever recorded it, you know, was telling them that their mom has gone away and she might not be coming back for quite a while.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so it's actually, you know, pretty cruel.
Yeah.
And to record that for Lou's nefarious purposes.
Right, yeah.
But
it's a great album for what it is. If you're ever feeling really miserable about, a girl or something, a woman, like really miserable, I put that one on, chug on a bottle of bourbon or something.
I have a question, I view Lou Reed in the rear view mirror, right? Like when I discovered him in the mid 80s, he was kind of like an alt indie rock god, right? They were they released VU, and he was like this cool template for at the time what they were calling like college rock or alternative rock. But who was buying Berlin in 1973, you know? That's my question.
The people didn't sell, I don't think, nearly as well as...
No.
And that's why he had to get the band together, the Hunter Wagner Band, to do Rock and Roll Animal and tour it and eventually release that album. And, that actually made him some money, stayed on the charts a good long time, like years.
The next album we're going to discuss, that went gold, actually.
Yeah, so who was buying Berlin? Not a lot of people. They weren't buying it. They bought Transformer because of Walk on the Wild Side and the Bowie connection. And
it did better. It charted better in the U.S. So the first album charted 189 on the U.S. charts. Transformer made it to 29. Berlin made it to 98.
Yeah, so, not a lot of people bought it. And probably RCA was saying, Lou, we need to make some money here off you. Are you going to tour behind this? Tell you what, we'll get, Bob Ezrin will whip this stupid band together for you. Alice Cooper Hacks and... people like that. They're great players and all that, and it's a great album for what it's worth. I guess we're coming up on that right now. It's Rock and Roll Animal.
Yeah, that's a good segue, right? That's now we're into February 74.
It starts out really strong. That intro to Sweet Jane, which is a song in itself.
Oh, yeah.
It's very funky and... very of the times, very, still got the screaming, muso lead guitars, but it's also got this, funky rhythm section. Prakash John, Penty Glenn, Whitey Glenn, as they called them, or Canadian, players.
And that was a big hit with, I remember the Cowboy Junkies had a hit with the cover version of that in the 80s. He's very reverby.
Oh, Sweet Jane, yeah, it's great. Lou famously had a sticker on the album saying Lou Reed says this is his favorite cover version of the song ever.
Mm-hmm.
Including Papa Hoople's, very good cover of the, ever.
The classic.
By hundreds of people. And the Cowboy Junkies utilized the bridge at, the Heavenly Wine and Roses bridge, which was... butchered and cut out from the original studio version the Loaded album.
I forgot about that.
Restored on the Fully Loaded album.
But they did do the bridge on this live album?
No. Lou never did the bridge.
Oh, he didn't? Okay.
Until the New York album. He'd do Sweet Jane as, after playing the entire, New York album. Do a couple oldies as encores and and that was 1989-90, so I think he started doing the bridge live then, and even after then.
And this is a crazy album. Looking at the track listing, there's only 5 songs on this album.
Yeah, 2 more were added for a remaster about the turn of the century, 2000, 2001. Caroline says one or two, there's 2 versions. Caroline says 1, Caroline says 2. on the album.
And How Do You Think It Feels was added.
How Do You Think It Feels, yeah. And Lou approved these and approved, you know, the remaster and everything. You know, a year later, with Lou Reed Live, which is the remainder of that show at the Howard Stein Academy of Music in Brooklyn, they released that. Or Lou didn't want it released. Sonically, they reversed Hunter and Wagner's guitars on the two different channels, right and left versus left and right. And
the producer was Steve Katz, who was a guitarist. He was a member of Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Blood, Sweat, and Tears, yeah, right. And he's his manager, too. Producer. It's a very well-recorded album. Maybe had a lot to do with it. Maybe Lou just wasn't interested and just sat there drinking in his own, you know, dressing room or whatever, and doing speed and maybe the Steve Katz, you know.
He kind of like
orchestrated all the, you know, his entire band for, you know, a year.
It kind of works, you know, because it's just, I love hearing a great, like, rockin', well-recorded album, but it kind of gives me sonic whiplash, you know, knowing what he did with the Velvet Underground, to hear him play with Alice Cooper Musos. But it is a fun record, and it rocks.
It does, yeah. If you're into that kind of thing.
You know, if you're just, it's, you want to crank up some rock and roll on some speakers, you know, if you're in the proper right kind of mood, it can sound pretty great.
Yeah, it can. It's the guitars mainly. I just, you know, don't really dig that kind of guitar part.
Yeah, right. No. It's like that noodly, self-indulgent.
Well, I don't know. Lou could be pretty self-indulgent, too. I heard a Call My Name. But that's the reason that I gravitate towards Lou's style of guitar playing, rhythm and lead. He's great at both and very, you know, singular and distinct. So I didn't want to hear the Hunter Wagner, that style of guitar playing, which was all the rage for many years in the Western world, in Western music, Western popular music.
Right. You know, let's face it, if this record didn't happen, he may have been dropped by his record company eventually, if he didn't, you know, have a good selling record. So he probably needed it career-wise.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly what happened. And then look what happened to his next album, his next studio album. It went top 10. Yeah.
Sally Can't Dance, right? Should we move on to that one?
Well, we're already there, yeah. I don't think, you know, he had anything. He did a re-recorded version, not just an edit, but an actual re-recorded lyric for the title song, Sally Can't Dance, which is released on a, you know, remaster, you know, later in 2001 or whatever. But no radio songs. He revived the title track and played that and the Kill Eater's Sons. He had a special affection for that song. He played that a lot, especially during the Klein years, the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
But it's essentially the same deal. It's some of the Rock and Roll Animal Band, Penty Glam, drums, and I don't think Hunter Wagner playing it. I think another guy who plays just like Hunter Wagner plays on it, somebody from Blood, Sweat, and Tears, or whatever, Practice John. Well, it's just a studio concoction where Lou just showed up and did vocals.
Let's face it, you know, he was kind of lazy, and eventually you know, he would find his own voice, but it would be a few years from now until that happened.
His physical voice is a lot of people like his physical, you know, musicianly voice.
Yeah, but I'm talking, you know what I mean? Just his musical voice overall, like his aesthetic.
Well, his literary voice, I guess I'd call it. No, he regained that, you know, later. But, you know, bits and pieces, though. But you can, you know, there's songs on it. You know, the last song on the album, Billy, which is just Lou on acoustic, Doug Yule actually playing bass, and a tenor sax. And it's a beautiful, really, really a bummer of a song. Friend did well in high school and then college. Lou dropped out. His friend got drafted into the army or the military, sent to Vietnam.
Yeah.
Lou was given a deferment for being psychologically unstable.
Right.
And his friend came back from Vietnam, and he wasn't the same.
Oh, okay.
He was like talking to a door. It's a vicious song, too. It's vicious against his friend. You know, you're a shell, but not me, not me. I'm still here, and I'm still doing my Lou Reed thing. So it's a vicious song, too. It's got a really bad attitude. The song is disguised as a sweet song of remembrance. And,
right, yeah. Like a lot of the best songs do, like, it gives you a certain feeling, which most people aren't going to listen to the underwriting story.
Yeah, you know, who knows what Lou was feeling when he wrote the song, recorded it. You know, maybe, who knows? Maybe he like recorded it 15 minutes or wrote it 15 minutes before he recorded it. Who knows? It's got that feel, this offhand feel. Lou had really bad attitudes during those days. You know, listen to the Berlin album, you know, for proof. He's cynical about his audience. He's cynical about a whole lot of things. And he tried to paint a different picture retrospectively in his later years when he was sober and, you know. It's a pretty vicious song. And speaking of vicious songs from Sell I Can't Dance, how about Ennui? I guess you could look at the lyrics here or something.
Okay.
It's one of the most depressing songs ever recorded by anybody.
Okay.
And it's not empathetic, although at times it can seem empathetic in the lyric. It's also pretty nasty, pretty vicious. And you think Lou sounds not so engaged on the Transformer album vocally. Sell I Can't Dance. It's like, it's just bad vibes all around. The entire album is bad vibes, you know, with this slick, you know, modern urban R&B, you know, backing tracks. That's what I consider them to be, backing tracks, not, you know, actually.
Yeah, this is, it's very concise in its derision. All the things you said, you thought I was dead, everything made me feel where. You're getting old, you're losing your hair, you're guilty of reason. You're the kind of person I could do without.
Yeah, you got to hear Lou's voice doing it, though. That's, you know, that's one of the miracles of Lou Reed as a, if not singer, at least a vocalist.
Yeah.
It's how he phrases. It's precisely how he phrases, no matter what his state of mind or chemical intake is or isn't. And he's a great vocalist that way. I tell probably, you know, later, or, you know, it's very late in his career where he thought he could be, you know, Otis Redding and, you know, do a lot of hollering and shouting. That didn't work so well. But yeah, it's pretty scathing. And musically, it's just this lullaby, this sort of floating narcoleptic lullaby with really loud drums playing a really, really slow cut time, you know, blues rhythm,
very slow late night. Instrumentally, it's just weird. It's slick, you know, by 1974 standards. These days, it sounds a lot better, those records. A lot of these records I'm talking about, I'm poo-pooing, you know, Berlin, you know, the debut album. They sound so great now because of there's been, you know, 45 years of really awful sounding records and awful music to compare them to, you know? Right. So yeah, it actually sounds funky and groovy and nasty. It's probably how it was intended to sound. I'm talking about Sally Can't Dance, the album here. So, okay, well, Sally Can't Dance. It's probably the last album of Lou's, studio album of Lou's decadent period, shall we say. His next studio outing would be far more considered, musically, sonically.
Metal Machine Music.
Well, no, Coney Island, baby. But Metal Machine Music, that you can't ignore that. No, you definitely cannot ignore Metal Machine Music.
Because I think we could bookend this conversation with Lou Reed Live, which came out in March 75, and then continue it next time with Metal Machine Music, which is July 75.
If you want to, sure.
Just because I need to go do my homework and, you know, listen to Metal Machine Music and Coney Island Baby and these other records.
Good luck with Metal Machine Music.
I actually like Metal Machine Music. I've listened to it, you know, here and there.
Yeah, I regularly use it too, semi-regularly for, you know, Tai Chi, you know, practice.
Yeah, no, I dig it.
That's a good time for him to take a break and reconsider, because he's coming back with Coney Island Baby. That would be sort of his real rejuvenation. He's had a couple rejuvenations or alleged rejuvenations, rebirths in his career, but that would be the first one of it. Metal Machine Music, that's something, you know, that's a beast unto itself. So, Lou Reed Live, it's basically, you know, rock and roll animal. Great songs played by that band, which is really good. If you like that kind of thing. And, you know, same gig, you know, sonically, just, you know, it's everything that rock and roll animal is, except they're different songs.
Does it make, like, when you listen to these two, do you think the songs are as good as on Rock and Roll Animal? Do their editing choices make any sense? You know, when the first album was going to come out and they're like, well, what should we put on here? And they didn't know they're going to do Lou Reed Live, which you told me Lou didn't want to release.
Right.
You know, are some of the songs better on Lou Reed Live than Rock and Roll Animal? Or do you think they're all pretty equal on the two albums?
I think they're all equal.
Yeah.
From Rock and Roll Animal, you know, Heroin is really startling. It's really long. And it's very theatrical. You know, the intro to Sweet Jane is very impressive. And then when it actually comes in, you hear the crowd go nuts, because obviously Lou's walk on stage. I think it's the equal of Rock and Roll Animal, even, you know, the re-release with the two extra songs on it.
Yeah,
you know, makes up the entirety of the gig. I burned, you know, a few years ago, whatever, you know, a CD, well, two CDs of the show in running order. You know, looking on the internet on, you know, Last FM or whatever, you know, the actual running order of the show. And, you know, burn from the two CDs, you know, the songs all in the proper order. And other than reversing, you know,
Hunter and Wagner's guitars from channel to channel between the two albums. There's no noticeable difference. Rock and Roll Animal, it was a remaster, so it was slightly better audio. Used to find Lou Reed live at for $3 at Walmart's or I think it sold a lot at truck stops around the country. Truckers would go in buy a handful of cassettes for 99¢ each or whatever, and then when CDs came out they'd be $3 a piece. So it's that kind of release. It never got, it was a horrible album cover, horrible album art. It was never remastered, not that it really needed it. It's so well recorded in the first place. But never re-released in Lou's lifetime, and even his posthumous, remastering campaign where he did everything. It's only vinyl release, so I haven't heard them.
Interesting bit of history about where this was recorded. It was originally called the Academy of Music, and then later it was rechristened the Palladium, where The Clash played, Springsteen, Patti Smith, John Cale.
I'm well familiar with the Palladium, but I did not know that. I didn't know the Howard Stein Academy of Music was the Palladium. I thought it was in Brooklyn.
It was the Palladium. And then it was demolished. It was purchased by NYU and demolished in the 90s to build a 12-story residence hall, unfortunately.
Oh, I've heard quite a few radio FM broadcasts and albums and parts of albums, individual songs recorded at the Palladium from, the 70s through the 80s. No, I never knew it was the Academy of Music. I always thought the Academy of Music was in Brooklyn. Wasn't the Palladium? Midtown or Manhattan?
126 East 14th Street. This is near the Village.
I see you near the Village.
Everyone, thanks for joining us today on the Culture Drop Podcast. That was part one of our multi-part discussion on the solo career of Lou Reed. Today was 1972 to 1975. Join us next time when we pick up again in 1975 we're going to start with Lou Reed's groundbreaking sonic exploration metal machine music. So catch you on the flip side.